This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The Hawk Eternal, written by David Gemmell and read by Adjoa Ando. Prologue. The young priest was sitting in the sunshine, studying an ancient manuscript. Slowly he ran his index finger over the symbols upon it, mouthing each one. It was cold up here by these ancient stones, but Garvis had wrapped himself in a hooded sheepskin cloak and had found a niche in the rocks away from the wind. He loved the solitude of these high, lonely peaks, and the distant roar of the mighty falls of Atafos was a faraway whisper upon the wind. "All the works of man are as dust upon a flat rock," he read. "When the winds of time blow across them, they are lost to history. Nothing built of stone will endure." Garvis sat back. Surely this was nonsense. These mountains had existed since the dawn of time, and they would be here long after he was dead. He glanced up at the old stone circle. The symbols upon each standing stone had weathered almost to nothing, yet still they stood, exactly where the ancients had placed them 1,000 years ago. The sun was high now, but there was little warmth in the rays. Gaunt shadows stretched out from the stones. Garvis pulled his cloak more tightly about him. According to the Lord Taliesin, this was once one of the great gates. From here a man could travel across time and space. Garvis rubbed a slender hand over his pockmarked face. Time and space. The legends fascinated him. He had asked Lord Taliesin about the ancient gates, and had been rewarded with extra study. The lesser gates still allowed a man to move through space. He himself had travelled with Lord Taliesin from the mountains to the outskirts of Arteris. That was more than 60 miles of space, but the journey had taken less than a heartbeat. According to Metas, the lesser gates could carry a man all over the land. So why were the great gates special? Garvis's attention was distracted momentarily as his fingers found a ripe spot upon his chin. Idly he squeezed it. It was not ready to burst, and pain flared across his face. Garvis gave a low curse and rubbed at the wounded skin. A hawk landed on the tallest of the standing stones, then flew away. Garvis watched it until it rose high on the thermals and was lost to him. "I would have liked to have been a hawk," he said aloud. Lightning flashed across the stones, a blaze of brightness that caused Garvis to fall backwards from the rock on which he sat. Rolling to his knees, he blinked and tried to focus. The stones seemed darker now. Violet light blazed out, and pale blue lightning forked up from the tallest stone. More lights flared, gossamer threads of light forming a glittering web around the stones. It seemed to Garvis as if tiny stars were caught in a pale blue net, gleaming like diamonds. It was the most beautiful sight. At the center of the light storm, one diamond grew larger and brighter than all the others, swelling until it was the size of a boulder. Then it flattened, spreading out like a sheet upon a washline, moving from circle to square, its four corners fastening to the top and bottom of two standing stones. The wind increased, howling over the crags, and for less than a heartbeat, two suns hung in the sky. All was silent as Garvis knelt, mouth open, shocked beyond words. Standing between the central stones was a tall warrior in blood-stained armour. He was supporting a woman, also attired for war. Blood was flowing from a wound in her side. Garvis had never seen armour quite like that worn by this fearsome pair. The man's helm was full-faced and boasted a white horsehair plume. His bronze breastplate had been fashioned in the shape of a human chest, complete with pectorals and a rippling solar plexus. He wore a leather kilt reinforced with bronze and high thigh-length riding boots. With a start, Garvis realized that the warrior was looking at him.
"You," he called, "help me."
Garvis scrambled to his feet and ran forward as the man lowered the warrior woman to the ground. Her face was grey, and blood had stained her silver hair. Garvis gazed down upon her. Old she was, but once she had been beautiful.
"Where is Taliesin?"
asked the warrior.
"Back at the fall, sir." We must take her to shelter. You understand, boy?
Shelter? Yes. The woman stirred. Reaching up, she gripped the warrior's arm.
You must go back. It is not over. Leave me with the boy. I will be fine. I shall not leave you, my lady. I have served you these 30 years. I cannot go now.
Reaching up, he made to remove his helm.
Leave it, she said, her voice ringing with authority. Listen to me, my dear friend. You must go back, or all may be lost. You are my heir. You are the son I never had. You are the light in my life. Go back. Set a lantern for me in the window. We should have killed the bitch all those years ago, he said bitterly. She was warped beyond evil.
No regrets, my general. Not ever. We win, we lose. The mountains do not care. Go now, for I can feel the air of the enchanted realm healing my wounds even as we speak. Go. Taking her hand, he kissed it.
Rising, he gazed around at the mountains. With a sigh, he drew his sword and ran back to the stones. Lightning flickered once more. Then he was gone. Garvis ran into Taliesin's chambers, his face flushed, eyes wide with excitement.
A warrior woman has appeared by the ancient gate, he said. She's wounded and nigh to death.
The old man rose and gathered up his cloak of feathers.
The ancient gate, you say?
Yes, Lord Taliesin.
Where have you taken her?
I helped her to the supply cave on Hydruin. It was the closest shelter I could find. Metis was there, and he has stitched her wounds, but I fear there is internal bleeding.
Taliesin took a breath.
Has she spoken of herself?
Not a word, Lord. Metis is still with her.
That is as it should be. Go now and rest. Make sure that not one word is spoken of this, not even to a brother druid. You understand me?
Of course, Lord.
Be sure that you do, for if I hear any whisper of it, I shall turn your bones to stone, your blood to dust.
Taliesin swung the cloak of feathers about his skinny shoulders and strode from his rooms. 2 hours later, having activated one of the lesser gates, he was climbing the eastern face of Hydruin and feeling the bitter wind biting through his cloak. The cave was deep and stacked with supplies to help wandering clansmen through the worst of the winter. Sacks of dried oats and dried fruit, salt and sugar, salted meat, and even a barrel of smoked fish. It was a haven for crofters and other travellers who needed to tackle the high passes in the winter months. There was a man-made hearth in the far corner, and 2 pallet beds. Also a bench table rudely fashioned from a split log, and 2 log rounds which served as seats. The druid met us, was seated upon one of the rounds, which he had placed beside a pallet bed. Upon it lay an old woman, bandages encasing her chest and shoulder. As Taliesin approached the bed, Metis rose and bowed. Taliesin praised him for his skill in administering to the woman, then repeated the warning he had given to the young druid when in his chambers.
All will be as you order, Lord, said Metis, bowing once more.
Taliesin sent him back to Valon and seated himself beside the sleeping woman. Even now, so close to death, her face radiated strength of purpose.
"You were a queen without peer, Sigarni," whispered Taliesin, taking hold of her hand and squeezing the fingers. "But are you the one who will save my people?"
Her eyes opened. They were the grey of a winter sky, and the look she gave him was piercing.
"Again we meet,"
she whispered, with a smile. The smile changed her face, returning to it the memory of youth and beauty he recalled so well.
"I fought the last battle, Taliesin."
He held up his hand.
"Tell me nothing," he said. "Already the strands of time are so interwoven that I find it hard to know when or where I am. I would dearly love to know how the ancient gate was opened. But I dare not ask. I will only assume that I did it. For now, you must rest and regain your strength. Then we will talk."
"I am so tired," she said. 40 years of war and loss, victory and pain. So tired. And yet it is good to be back in the enchanted realm.
Say nothing more, he urged her. We stand at a delicate place on the crossroads of time. Let me say only this. 2 days ago you urged me to hunt down Caracus and return to you the sword Scalivar. You remember asking me this?
She closed her eyes.
I remember. It was almost 30 years ago. And you did.
Yes, he said, his gaze drawn to the fabled sword that stood now against the far wall beside the fire.
You sent the goddess walking on the water of the pool below the falls. All my generals saw the miracle, and when word spread of it, men came flocking to my banner. I owe you much for that, Taliesin.
Her words faded away, and she fell into a deep sleep. Taliesin stood and walked to the sword, his thin fingers stroking the ruby pommel. He sighed and moved back into the sunlight.
The goddess upon the water, he repeated. What does she mean?
Taliesin had spent the last 2 days desperately trying to think of a way to achieve what the queen told him he already had. And he remembered the words of his master, Astolé, many centuries before.
Treat the gates with respect, Taliesin, lest you lose your mind. They are not merely doorways through time. You must understand that.
Oh, how he understood. He glanced back at the sleeping queen. How many times had he seen her die? 30? 50? Again the words of Astolé drifted back to haunt him.
Hold always to a line, my boy. A single thread. Never move between the threads, for that way lies madness and despair. For every moment that the past can conjure gives birth to an infinity of futures. Cross them at your peril.
The sun was hot upon Taliesin's face, though the wind remained cool.
I cross them, Astolé, he said. Now I am trapped in a future I cannot unravel. Why is she here? How was the gate opened? How was it that I returned her sword? Help me, Astolé, for I am lost, and my people face annihilation.
No answer came, and with a heavy heart, Taliesin returned to the cave. Chapter 1 Caswellon watched the murderous assault on Artoris, a strange sense of unreality gripping him. The clansman sat down on a boulder and gazed from the mountainside at the gleaming city below, white and glorious, like a child's castle set on a carpet of green. The enemy had surprised the city dwellers some 3 hours before, and black smoke billowed now from the turrets and homes. The distant sound of screaming floated to his ears, disembodied, like the echo of a nightmare upon awakening. The clansman's sea-green eyes narrowed as he watched the enemy hacking and slaying. He shook his head, sadness and anger competing within him. He had no love for these doomed lowlanders and their duplicitous ways, but equally this wanton slaughter filled him with sorrow. The enemy warriors were new to Caswellan. Never had he seen the horned helm of the Aeneir, the double-headed axes, nor the oval shields painted with hideous faces of crimson and black. He had heard of them, of course, butchering and killing far to the south, but of their war against the lowlanders he knew little, until now. But then, why should he? He was a clansman of the Farlan, and they had little time for lowland politics. His was a mountain race, tough and hardy and more than solitary. The mountains were forbidden ground for any lowlander, and the clans mixed not at all with other races. Save for trade. Clan beef and woven cloth for lowland sugar, fruits and iron. In the distance, Caswellan saw a young girl, speared and lifted into the air, thrashing and screaming.
This is war no longer, he thought. This is merely blood sport.
Tearing his gaze from the murderous scene, he glanced back at the mountains rearing like spear points towards the sky, snow-capped and proud, jagged and powerful. At their centre, the cloud-wreathed magnificence of Hydruin towered above the land. Caswellan shivered, drawing his brown leather cloak about his shoulders. It was said that the clans were vicious and hostile to outsiders, and so they were. Any lowlander found hunting clan lands was sent home minus the fingers of his right hand. But such punishments were intended to deter poachers. The scenes of carnage on the plain below had nothing to do with such practices. This was lust of the most vile kind. The clansmen looked back at the city. Old men in white robes were being nailed to the black gates. Even at this distance, Caswellan recognized Bacheron, the chief elder, a man of little honesty. Even so, he did not deserve such a death. By all the gods, no one deserved such a death. On the plain, three horsemen rode into sight, the leader pulling a young boy who was tied to a rope behind his mount. Caswellan recognized the boy as Galen, a thief and an orphan, who lived on scraps and stolen fruit. The clansman's fingers curled around the hilt of his hunting dagger as he watched the boy straining at the rope. The lead rider, a man in shining breastplate and raven-winged helm, cut the rope, and the boy began to run towards the mountains. The riders set off after him, lances leveled. Caswellan took a deep breath, releasing it slowly. The flame-haired boy ducked and weaved, stopping to pick up a stone and hurl it at the nearest horse. The beast shied, pitching its rider. "Good for you, Galen," whispered Caswellan. A rider in a white cloak wheeled his mount, cutting across the boy's path. The youngster turned to sprint away, and the lance took him deep in the back, lifting him from his feet and hurling him to the ground. He struggled to rise, and a second rider ended his torment, slashing a sword blade to his face. The riders cantered back to the city. Caswellan found his hands shaking uncontrollably, and his heart pounded, reflecting his anger and shame. How could men do such a thing to a youth? Caswellan recalled his last visit to Arteris 3 weeks before, when he had driven in 20 long-horned Highland cattle to the market stalls in the west of the city. He had stolen the beasts from the pastures of the Pallades 2 days before. At the market, he had seen a crowd chasing the red-haired youngster as he sprinted through the streets, his skinny legs pounding the marble walkway, his arms pumping furiously. Galen had shinned up a trellis by the side of the inn and leapt across the rooftops, stopping only to make an obscene gesture to his pursuers. Spotting Caswellan watching, he drew back his shoulders and swaggered across the rooftops. Caswellan had grinned then. He liked the boy. He had style. The fat butcher Leon had chuckled beside him. "He's a character, is Galen. Every city needs one." "Parents?" asked Caswellan. "Dead. He's been alone 5 years, since he was 9 or 10. "How does he survive?" "He steals. I let him get away with a chicken now and then. He sneaks up on me and I chase him for a while, shouting curses." "You like him, Leon?" "Yes, as I like you, Caswellan, you rascal. But then he reminds me of you. You are both thieves and you are both good at what you do, and there is no evil in either of you." "Nice of you to see so," said Caswellan, grinning. "Now, how much for the Pallades cattle?" "Why'd you do it?" "What?" asked Caswellan innocently. "Steal cattle. By all accounts, you were one of the richest clansmen in the Farlan. It doesn't make any sense." "Tradition," answered Caswellan. "I'm a great believer in it." Leon shook his head. "One of these days you'll be caught and hanged, or worse, knowing the Pallades. You baffle me." "No, I don't. I make you rich. Yours is the cheapest beef in Arteris." "True. How is the lovely Meg?" "She's well." "And Donal? Lungs like bellows." "Keeping you awake at nights, is he?" "When I'm not out hunting," said Caswellan with a wink. Leon chuckled. "I'm going to be sorry when they catch you, clansman, truly." For an hour they haggled over the prices, until Leon parted with a small pouch of gold, which Caswellan handed to his man Arcus, a taciturn clan crofter who accompanied him on his raids. Now, Caswellan stood on the mountainside, soaking in the horror of Aenea warfare. Arcus moved alongside him. Both men had heard tales of war in the south and the awful atrocities committed by the Aenea. Foremost among these was the Blood Eagle. Aenea victims were nailed to trees, their ribs splayed like tiny wings, their innards held in place with wooden strips. Caswellan had only half believed these tales. Now the evidence hung on the blood-drenched gates of Arteris. "Go back to the valley, my friend," Caswellan told Arcus. "What about the cattle? Drive them back into the mountains. There are no buyers today." "Gods, Caswellan, why do they go on killing? There's no one fighting them."
"I don't know.
Tell Campbell what we have seen today."
"What about you?"
"I'll stay for a while." Arcus nodded and set off across the slopes, running smoothly. After a while, the Aenea warriors drifted into the city. The plain before the gates was littered with corpses. Caswellan moved closer, stopping when he neared the tree line. Now, he could see the full scale of the horror, and his anger settled, cold and malignant. The cattle dealer, Leon, lay in a pool of blood, his throat torn open. Near him was the boy thief Galen. Caswellan swung away and moved back towards the trees.
"I am dying."
There was no doubt in Galen's mind. The pain from his lower back was close to unbearable. His head ached. The blood was seeping from his left eye. For a long while he lay still, not knowing if the enemy was close by, whether indeed an Aenea warrior was at this moment poised above him with a spear or a sharp-edged sword. Fear cut through his pain, but he quelled it savagely. He could feel the soft, dusty clay against his face and smell the smoke from the burning city. He tried to open his eyes, but blood had congealed on the lashes.
"I have been unconscious for some time," he thought. "An hour? Less?"
Carefully, he moved his right arm, bringing his hand to his face, rubbing his right eye with his knuckle to free the lashes. The pain from his left eye intensified, and he left it alone, sealed shut. He was facing the shuttered gates and the ghastly ornaments they now carried. Around him the crows were already settling, their sharp beaks ripping at moist flesh. Two of them had landed on the chest of Leon. Galen looked away. There were no Aenea in sight. Gingerly he probed the wound above his left hip, remembering the lance that had cut through him as he ran. The wound still bled on both sides, and the flesh was angry and raw to the touch. Turning his head towards the mountains and the tall pine trees on the nearest slope, he tried to estimate the time it would take him to reach the safety of the woods. He made an effort to stand, but a roaring began in his ears like an angry sea. Dizziness swamped him, and he lost consciousness. When he awoke, it was close to dusk. His side was still bleeding, though it had slowed to a trickle, and once again he had to clear his eye of blood. When he had done so, he saw that he had crawled 20 paces. He couldn't remember doing it, but the trail of blood and scored dust could not lie. Behind him the city burned. It would not be long before the Aenea returned to the plain. If he was found, he would be hauled back and blood-eagled like the elders. The boy began to crawl, not daring to look up lest the distance demoralize him, forcing him to give in. Twice he passed out for short periods. After the last, he cursed himself for a fool and rolled to his back, ripping 2 strips of cloth from his ragged tunic. These he pressed into the wounds on his hip, grunting as the pain tore into him.
"They should slow the bleeding," he thought.
He crawled on. The journey, begun in pain and weakness, became a torment. Delirious, Galen lived again the horror of the attack. He had stolen a chicken from Leon and was racing through the market when the sound of screaming women and pounding hooves made him forget the burly butcher. Hundreds of horsemen came into sight, slashing at the crowd with long swords and plunging lances. All was chaos, and the boy had been petrified. He had hidden in a barn for several hours, but then had been discovered by three Aeneas soldiers. Galen had run through the alleys, outpacing them, but had emerged into the city square, where a rider looped a rope over his shoulders, dragging him out through the broken gates. All around him were fierce-eyed warriors with horned helms, screaming and chanting, their faces bestial. The rider with a hope hailed two others at the city gates.
"Sport, father!"
yelled the man, his voice muffled by his helm.
"From that wretch!"
answered the other contemptuously, leaning across the neck of his horse. The helm he wore carried curved horns and a face mask in bronze, fashioned into a leering demon. Through the upper slits, Galen could see a glint of ice-blue eyes, and fear turned to terror within him. The rider who had roped Galen laughed.
"I saw this boy on my last scouting visit. He was running from a crowd. He's fast. I'll wager I'll land him before you."
"You couldn't land a fish from a bowl," said the third rider,
a tall, wide-shouldered warrior with an open helm. His face was broad and flat, the eyes small and glittering like blue beads. His beard was yellow and grimy, his teeth crooked and broken.
"But I'll get him by Vatten."
"Always the first to boast and the last to do, Tostig," sneered the first rider.
"Be silent, Ongist,"
ordered the older man in the horned helm.
"All right. I'll wager 10 gold pieces I got him."
"Done!"
The rider leaned over towards the boy, slicing the dagger through the rope.
"Go on, boy! Run!"
Galen heard the horse start after him, and throwing himself to the ground, he grabbed a rock and hurled it. The yellow-bearded warrior, Tostig, pitched from his rearing mount. Then the lance struck him. He tried to rise, only to see a sword blade flash down.
"Well ridden, father,"
were the last words he heard before the darkness engulfed him. Now, as he crawled, all sense of time and place deserted him. He was a turtle on a beach of hot coals, slow burning, a spider within an enamel bowl of pain, circling, a lobster within a pan as the heat rose. But still, he crawled. Behind him walked the yellow-bearded warrior he had pitched to the ground. In his hand was a sword, and upon his lips a smile. Tostig was growing bored now. At first he'd been intrigued by the wounded boy, wondering how far he could crawl, and imagining the horror and despair when he discovered the effort was for nothing. But now the boy was obviously delirious, and there was little point in wasting time. He raised the sword, pointing downward above the boy's back.
"Kill him, my bonny, and you will follow him."
Tostig leapt back a pace, his sword flashing up to point towards the shadow-haunted trees as a figure stepped out into the fading light. He was tall, wearing a leather cloak and carrying an iron-tipped quarterstaff. Two daggers hung from a black leather baldric across his chest, and a long hunting knife dangled by his hip. He was green-eyed, and a dark trident beard gave him a sardonic appearance. Tostig looked beyond the man, straining to pierce the gathering darkness of the undergrowth. The warrior seemed to be alone. The clansman stepped forward and stopped just out of reach of the Aeneas sword. Then he leaned on his staff and smiled.
"Your own Farlan land," he said.
"The Aenea walk where they will,"
Tostig replied.
"Not here, my bonny. Not ever.
Now, what's it to be? Do you leave or die?"
Tostig pondered a moment. His father, Asbedag, had warned the army not to alienate the clans. Not yet. One mouthful at a time. That was Asbedag's way. And yet this clansman had robbed Tostig of his prey.
"Who are you?"
Tostig countered.
"Your heart has about 5 beats of life left in it, barbarian," said Caswellan.
Tostig stared deeply into the sea-green eyes. Had he been sure the man was alone, he would have risked battle. But he was not sure. The man was too confident, too relaxed. No clansman alive would face an armed Aeneir in such a way. Unless he had an edge. Tostig glanced once more at the trees. Archers no doubt had him in range at this moment.
"We will meet again," he said, backing away down the slope.
Caswellan ignored him and knelt by the bleeding youngster. Gently he turned him to his back, checking his wounds. Satisfied they were plugged, he lifted the boy to his shoulder, gathered up his staff, entered the shadows, and was gone from the sight of the Aeneir. Galen turned in his bed and groaned as the stitches front and back pulled at tender, bruised flesh. He opened his eyes and found himself staring at a grey cave wall. The smell of burning beechwood was in his nostrils. Carefully he moved onto his good side. He was lying on a broad bed, crafted from pine and expertly joined. Over his body were two woolen blankets and a bearskin cloak. The cave was large, maybe 20 paces wide and 30 deep, and at the far end it curved into a corridor. Looking back, the boy saw that the entrance was covered with a hide curtain. Gingerly he sat up. Somebody had bandaged his side and his injured eye. Gently he probed both areas. The pain was still there, but more of a throbbing reminder of the acute agony he remembered from his long crawl. Across from the bed, beyond a table and some chairs rough cut from logs, was a man-made hearth skillfully chipped away at the base of a natural chimney in the cave wall. A fire was burning brightly. Beside it were chunks of beechwood, a long iron rod, and a copper shovel. Bright sunlight shafted past the edges of the curtain, and the boy's gaze was drawn to the cave entrance. Groaning as he rose, he limped across the cave, lifting the flap and looking out over the mountains beyond. He found himself gazing down into a green and gold valley, dotted with stone buildings and wooden barns, sectioned fields and ribboned streams. Away to his left was a herd of shaggy long-horned cattle, and elsewhere he could see sheep and goats, and even a few horses in a paddock by a small wood. His legs began to tremble, and he dropped the curtain. Slowly he made his way to the table and sat down. Upon it was an oatmeal loaf and a jug of spring water. His stomach tightened, hunger surging within him as he tore a chunk from the loaf and poured a little water into a clay goblet. Galen was confused. He had never been this far into the highlands. No lowlander had. This was forbidden territory. The clansmen were not a friendly people, and though they occasionally came into Arteris to trade, it was well known to be folly for any city dweller to attempt a return visit. He tried to remember how he had come here. He seemed to recall voices as he struggled to reach the trees, but the memory was elusive, and there had been so many dreams. At the back of the cave, the man, called Oracle, watched the boy eating and smiled. The lad was strong and wolf-tough. For the 5 days he had been here, he had battled grimly against his wounds, never crying, even when in his delirium he had relived fear-filled moments of his young life. He had regained consciousness only twice in that time, accepting silently the warm broth that Oracle held to his lips.
"I see you are feeling better,"
said the old man, stepping from the shadows. The boy jumped and winced as the stitches pulled. Looking round, he saw a tall, frail, white-bearded man dressed in grey robes, belted at the waist with a goat-hair rope. "Yes, thank you."
"What is your name?"
"Galen. And you?"
"I no longer use my name, but it pleases the Farland to call me Oracle. If you are hungry, I shall warm some broth. It is made from the liver of pigs and will give you strength."
Oracle moved to the fire, stooping to lift a covered pot to the flames.
"It will be ready soon. How are your wounds?"
"Better." The old man nodded,
The eye caused me the most trouble, but I think it will serve you. You will not be blind, I think. The wound in your side is not serious, the lance piercing just above the flesh of the hip. No vital organ was cut.
Did you bring me here?
No.
Using the iron rod, Oracle lifted the lid from the pot. Taking a long-handled wooden spoon from a shelf, he stirred the contents. Galen watched him in silence. In his youth he must have been a mighty man, thought the boy. Oracle's arms were bony now, but the wrists were thick, and his frame broad. The old man's eyes were light blue under thick brows, and they glittered like water on ice. Seeing the boy staring at him, he chuckled.
"I was the Farlan Hunt Lord," he said, grinning, "and I was strong. I carried the Whirl Boulder for 42 pieces. No man has bettered that in 30 years.
"Am I thought so obvious?" Galen asked.
"Yes," answered the oracle. "The broth is ready."
They ate in silence, spooning the thick soup from wooden bowls and dipping chunks of oatmeal loaf into the steaming liquid. Galen could not finish the broth. He apologized, but the old man shrugged.
"You've hardly eaten at all in 5 days, and though you are ravenous, your stomach has shrunk. Give it a few moments, then try a little more."
"Thank you."
"You ask few questions, young Galen. Is it that you lack curiosity?"
The boy smiled for the first time. "No, I just don't want any answers yet."
Oracle nodded. "You're safe here. No one will send you back to the Anir. You are welcome, free to do as you wish. You're not a prisoner. Now, do you have any questions?"
How did I get here?"
"Kazolan brought you. He's a clansman, a hunt master."
"Why did he save me?"
"Why does Kazolan do the things he does? I don't know. Kazolan doesn't know. He's a man of impulse. A good friend, a terrible enemy, and a fine clansman. But still, a man of impulse. When he was a youth, he went tracking deer. He was following a doe when he came upon it, caught in a Palades snare. Now, the Farlan have no love for the Palades, so Kazolan cut the deer loose, only to find it had an injured leg. He brought the little beast home upon his back and nursed it to health. Then he released it. There's no accounting for Kazolan. Had the beast been fit, he would have slain it for meat and hide."
"And am I like that injured doe?" said Galen. "Had I run into the trees unharmed, Kazolan might have killed me."
"Yes, you are sharp, Galen. I like quick wits in a boy. How old are you?"
The boy shrugged. "I don't know. 14? 15?
"I'd say nearer 14, but it doesn't matter. A man is judged here by how he lives, not by the weight of his years."
"Will I be allowed to stay, then? I thought only clansmen could live in the Druin Mountains."
"Indeed you can, for indeed you are,"
said Oracle. "I don't understand."
"You are a clansman, Galen, of the Farlan. You see, Kazolan invoked the Cormach. He has made you his son."
"Why?"
"Because he had no choice. As you said yourself, only a clansman can live here, and Kazolan, like all other clansmen, cannot bring strangers into the Farlan. And therefore, in the very act of rescuing you, he became your guardian, responsible in law for everything you do."
"I don't want a father," said Galen. "I get by on my own."
"Then you will leave,"
agreed Oracle, amiably,
"and Kazolan will give you a cloak, a dagger, and 2 gold coins for the road."
"And if I stay?"
"Then you will move into Kazolan's house."
Needing time to think, Galen broke off a piece of bread and dipped it into the now lukewarm broth. become a clansman, a wild warrior of the mountains? And what would it be like to have a father? Caswell and whoever he was wouldn't care for him. Why should he? He was just a wounded doe brought home on a whim. When must I decide?
When your wounds are fully healed.
How long will that be?
When you see they are,
said the old man. I don't know if I want to be a clansman.
Reserve your judgment, Galen, until you know what it entails.
That night, Galen awoke in a cold sweat, screaming. The old man ran from the back of the cave, where he slept on a narrow pallet bed, and sat down beside the boy.
"What is it?"
he asked, stroking Galen's brow, pushing back the sweat-drenched hair from the boy's eyes.
"The Aeneir. I dreamed they'd come for me, and I couldn't get away."
"Do not fear, Galen. They have conquered the lowlands, but they will not come here. Not yet. Believe me, you are safe."
"They took the city," said Galen. "And the militia were overrun. They didn't even hold for a day."
"You have much to learn, boy, about war, about warriors. Aye, the city fell, and before it other cities. But we don't have cities here, and we need no walls. The mountains are like a fortress, with walls that pierce the clouds. And the clansmen don't wear bright breastplates and parade at festivals. They don't march in unison. Stand a clansman against a lowlander, and you will see two men, but you will not be seeing clearly. The one is like a dog, well-trained and well-fed. It looks good, and it barks loud. The other is like a wolf, lean and deadly. It barks not at all. It kills. The Aeneir will not come here yet. Trust me."
When he woke, Galen found a fresh-baked honey-malt loaf, a jug of goat's milk, and a bowl containing oats, dried apple and ground hazelnuts, awaiting him at the table. There was no sign of Oracle. Galen's side was sore, and fresh blood had seeped through the linen bandages around his waist, but he pushed the pain from his mind and ate. The oats were bland and unappealing, but he found that if he crushed the honey cake and sprinkled it over the mixture, the effect was more appetizing. His stomach full, he made his way outside the cave and knelt by a slender stream that trickled over white rocks on its journey to the valley below. Scooping water to his face, he washed, careful to avoid dampening the bandage over his injured eye. He had thought to take a short walk, but even the stroll to the stream had tired him, and he sat back against a smooth rock and gazed down into the valley. It was so calm here. Set against the tranquillity of these mountain valleys, the events at Arteris seemed even more horrifying. Galen saw again the crows settling on Fat Leon, squabbling and fighting over a strip of red flesh. The boy was not surprised by the Aeneir savagery. It seemed a culmination of all that life had taught him about people. In the main, they were cruel, callous and uncaring, filled with greed and petty malice. The boy knew all about suffering. It was life. It was being frozen in winter, parched in summer, cold-soaked and trembling when it rained. It was being thrashed for the sin of hunger, abused for the curse of loneliness, tormented for being a bastard, and despised for being an orphan. Life was not a gift to be enjoyed. It was an enemy to be battled, grimly, unremittingly. The old man had been kind to him, but he has his reasons, thought Galen sourly. This Caswellan is probably paying him for his time. Galen sighed. When he was strong enough, he would run away to the north and find a city the Aeneir had not sacked, and he would pick up his life again, stealing food and scraping a living, until he was big enough or strong enough to take life by the throat and force it to do his bidding. Still dreaming of the future, he fell asleep in the sunshine. Oracle found him there at noon and gently carried him inside, laying him upon the broad bed and covering him with the bearskin cloak. The fur was still thick and luxuriant, yet it was 30 years since Oracle had killed the bear. An epic battle, fought on a spring day, such as this. The old man chuckled at the memory. In those days, he had been Karakis, Hunt Lord of the Farlan, and a force to be considered. He had killed the bear with a short sword and dagger, suffering terrible wounds from the beast's claws. He never knew why it had attacked him. The large bears of the mountains usually avoided man. But perhaps he had strayed too close to its den. Or maybe it was sick and hurting. Whatever the cause, it had reared up from the bushes, towering above him. In one flowing motion he had hurled his hunting knife into its breast, drawn sword and dagger, and leapt forward, plunging both blades through the matted fur and into the flesh beyond. The battle had been brief and bloody. The beast's great arms encircled him, its claws ripping into his back. He had released the sword and twisted at the dagger with both hands, seeking the mighty heart within the ribcage, and he had found it. Now the bear, the lord of the high, lonely forest, was a child's blanket, and the greatest of the Farlan warriors was a dry-boned ancient, known only as Oracle. "Time makes fools of us all," he whispered. He looked down at the boy's face. He was a handsome lad with good bones and a strong chin, and his flame-red hair contained a glint of gold, matching the tawny flecks in his dark eyes. "You will break hearts in years to come, Galen, my lad."
"Hearts," said Galen, yawning and sitting up. "I'm sorry. Were you talking to me?"
"No. Old men talk to themselves. How are you feeling?"
"Good."
"Sleep is the remedy for many of life's ills, especially loss of blood."
"It's peaceful here," said Galen. "I don't normally sleep so much, even when I've been hurt. Is there anything I can do to help you? I don't want to be a burden."
"Young man, you are not a burden. You are a guest. Do you know what that means?"
"No."
"It means you are a friend who has come to stay for a while,"
the old man told him, laying his hand on the boy's arm.
"It means you owe me nothing."
"Caswellan pays you to look after me," said Galen, pulling his arm away from Oracle's touch.
"No, he does not, nor will he, though he may bring a joint of venison or a sack of vegetables the next time he comes."
Oracle left the bedside to add several chunks of wood to the fire.
"It's so wasteful," he called back, "keeping a fire here in spring. But the cave gets cold, and my blood is running thin."
"It's nice," said Galen. "I like to see a fire burning."
"Chopping wood keeps my body from seizing up,"
said the old man, returning to the bedside.
"Now, what would you like to know?"
Galen shrugged. "About what?"
"About anything."
"You could tell me about the clans. Where did they come from?"
"A wise choice,"
said Oracle, sitting at the bedside.
"There are more than 30 clans, but originally there was one, the Farlan. Under their leader, Farla the First, they journeyed to Druin more than 600 years ago, escaping some war in their homeland. The Farlan settled in the valley below here, and two neighbouring valleys to the east. They prospered and multiplied, but as the years passed, there was discord and several families broke from the clan. There was a little trouble and some fighting, but the new clan formed their own settlements and began calling themselves Palades, which in the old tongue means seeker of new trails. In the decades that followed, other splits developed, giving birth to the Hasten, the Loda, the Dunalds, and many more. There have been several wars between the clans. In the last, more than 100 years ago, 6,000 men lost their lives. Then the mighty king, Ironhand, put an end to it. He gave us wisdom and the games."
"What are the games?"
asked Galen,
Tests of skill in a score of disciplines. Archery, swordsmanship, racing, jumping, wrestling. Many, many events. All the clans take part. It lasts 2 weeks, from Midsummer's night, and concludes with a world feast. You will see it this year, and you will never forget it.
What are the prizes?
Pride is the prize, and always has been.
The old man's blue eyes twinkled.
Well, pride in a small sack of gold. Caswellan took gold in the archery last year. A better bowman has never been seen in these mountains.
Tell me of him.
The old man chuckled and shook his head. Caswellan. Always the children seek stories of Caswellan. If Caswellan were a swallow, he would stay north for the winter just to see how cold it gets. What can any man tell you of Caswellan?
Is he a warrior?
He is certainly that, but then most clansmen are. He is good with sword and knife, though others are better. He's an expert hunter and a good provider.
You like him? Asked Galen.
Like him? He infuriates me. But I love him. I don't know how his wife puts up with him. But then, Meg's a spirited lass.
Oracle rose from the bedside and moved to the table, filling 2 clay goblets with water. Passing one to Galen, he sat down once more.
Aye, that's the story to give you a taste of young Caswellan. 3 years ago, at the games, he saw and fell in love with a maid of the Pallades, the daughter of their hunt lord, Margrig. Now, Margrig is a formidable warrior and a man of hasty and uncertain temper. Above all things on this earth, he hates and despises the Farlan. Mention the clan name and his blood boils and his face darkens. So, imagine his fury when Caswellan approaches him and asks for his daughter's hand. Men close by swore his veins almost burst at the temples. And Meg herself took one look at him and dismissed him for an arrogant fool. Caswellan took the insults they heaped on him, bowed, and departed to the archery tourney, which he won an hour later. Most of us thought that would be the last of the affair.
Oracle rose and stretched his back, then moved to the fire and added 2 thick logs. He sighed and refilled his goblet.
Well, what happened? Urged Galen.
Happened? Oh, yes, I'm sorry, my boy, but the mind wanders sometimes. Where was I? Caswellan's courting of Meg.
Returning to the bedside, he sat down again.
Many of the Farlon enjoyed the jest, for such it had to be. Meg was almost 20 and unmarried, and it was considered she was a frosty maiden with little interest in men. 2 months later, in dead of night, Caswellan slipped into the Pallades lands, past their scouts, and into the heart of Magrig's own village. He scaled the stone wall of the old man's house and entered Meg's room, unseen. Just before dawn, he awoke Meg, stifled her scream with a kiss, climbed from the window, and was gone into the timberline. Oh, they chased him all right. 50 of the fleetest Pallades runners. But Caswellan was the racer to beat them all, and he made it home without a scratch. Now, back at Margaret's house, there was rare fury, for the young Farlan hunter had left a pair of torn breeches, a worn shirt, and the hide cut out in the shape of a new pair of shoes. Soon the entire Highlands chuckled at the tale, and Magrig was beside himself with fury. You have to understand the symbolism, Galen. The trousers, shirt, and hide were what he'd leave a wife to mend and make, and the fact that he'd spent the night alone in her bedroom made sure no other man would marry her. Magrig swore he'd have his head. Pallades hunters spent their days hoping Caswellan of the Farlan would darken their territory with his shadow. Finally, some 3 months later, as winter took its hold, making the mountains impassable, the Pallades withdrew to their homes. On this night in the Long Hall, where the clan chiefs were celebrating the longest night, the doors opened, and there, covered in snow
and with ice in his beard, stood Caswallon. He walked slowly down the centre of the hall between the tables until he stood before Margaret and his daughter. Then he smiled and said, "Have you finished my breeches and shirt, woman?"
"I have,"
she told him. "And where have you been these last months?" "Where else should I be?" he answered her. "I've been building our house." "I tell you, Galen, I would have given much to see Margaret's face that night." The wedding took place the following morning, and the two of them stayed most of the winter with the Pallades. Caswallon would not hear of taking Meg back the way he had come, for he had scaled the east flank of High Druin. No easy task in summer, but in winter, fraught with peril. Now, does that help you understand, Caswallon of the Farlan?
No,
answered Galen. The old man laughed aloud. No more should it, I suppose. But keep it in your mind, and the passing years may explain it to you. Now, strip off that shirt, and let me check that wound.
Oracle carefully cut away the bandages and knelt before the bed, his long fingers prising away the linen from the blood-encrusted stitches. Galen gritted his teeth, making no sound. As the last piece of linen pulled clear, Galen looked down. A huge blue and yellow bruise had spread from his hip to his ribs and round to the small of his back. The wound itself had closed well, but was seeping at the edges with yellow pus.
"Don't worry about that, boy," said Oracle. "That's just the body, expelling the rubbish. The wound's clean and healing well. By midsummer you'll be running with the other lads at the games."
"The wound seems wider than I remember," said Galen. "I thought it was just a round hole."
"Aye, it was. On both sides," Oracle told him. "But round wounds take an age to heal, Galen. They close up in a circle until there's just a bright, tender spot at the centre which never seems to close. I cut a wider gash across it." "Trust me, I know wounds, boy. I've seen enough of them, and suffered enough of them. You are healing well."
"What about my eye?" asked Galen, tenderly fingering the bandage.
"We'll know soon, lad."
Meg placed the babe in his crib and covered him with a white woollen blanket. She ran her fingers over the soft dark down on his head and whispered a blessing to protect him as he slept. He was a beautiful child, with his father's sea-green eyes and his mother's dimpled chin. Tomorrow his grandfather would arrive, and Meg was secretly delighted that the child had Magrig's wide cheekbones and round head. She knew it would please the fiery hunt-lord of the Pallades. For all that he was a warrior and a man to be respected, Meg knew that within the crusty shell was a soft-hearted man who had always doted on children. Men walked warily round the old bull, but children clambered over him, shrieking with mock terror at his blood-curdling threats and tugging at his rust-red beard. He was a man who had always wanted sons, and yet had never made his daughter feel guilty, nor blamed his wife for becoming barren thereafter. And Meg loved him. The sound of the axe thudding into logs drew her to the thin north-facing window. In the yard beyond, stripped to the waist, Caswallon was preparing the winter fuel. An hour a day through spring and summer, and the logs would be stacked against the side of the house, 3 paces deep, 30 paces long, and the height of a tall man. In this way, the wood performed a double service, keeping the fire fed and the north wind away from the wall, insulating their home against the ferocity of the winter. Caswallon's long hair was swept back from his face and tied at the nape of the neck in a short ponytail. The muscles of his arms and shoulders stretched and swelled with each smooth stroke of the axe. Meg grinned as she watched him, and rested her elbows on the sill. Caswallon was a natural showman, imbuing even such a simple task as chopping wood with a sense of living poetry. His movements were smooth, and yet every now and then as he swung the axe, he twisted the handle, flashing the blade in a complete turn, before allowing it to hammer home in the log set on an oak round. It was almost theatrical, and well worth watching.
It was the same with everything he did, Meg knew. It wasn't that he needed to impress an audience. He was merely creative and easily bored, and amused himself by adding intricacy and often beauty to the most mundane of chores.